We come now then to the 16th chapter of the book of the Revelation. The dividing up of the chapter is quite straightforward. In verse 1, we have the prelude, a prelude to the plagues that are going to be poured out. And then there are seven divisions, easy to recognize, because there are seven plagues, seven bowls that are poured out. And so they're like seven bullet points. Verse 2, and the first, that is the first angel, went and poured out his vial. And then verse 3, the second angel poured out his vial. And then verse 4 through to 7, we have the third plague. The third angel poured out his vial. And then verses 8 and 9, the fourth plague, the fourth angel poured out his bowl. And then verses 10 and 11, the fifth plague, the fifth angel poured out his. And then longer paragraphs as we come to the end, verses 12 to 16, the sixth angel pouring out his plague. And then verses 17 to the end, the seventh angel pouring out his plague. So the divisions are very easy to mark and to observe. This chapter then commences with the prelude in verse 1. I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, "Go your ways and pour out the vials of the wrath of God upon the earth." Now, John has seen that temple vision at the end of chapter 15. We looked at that. The temple was filled with smoke. Smoke's coming from God's power and glory. It's so great that nobody can enter in, and John can't see God through the smoke. Now he hears a voice coming out of the temple. He can't see in, he can't go in, nobody can go in, but there's a great voice comes out of it through the smoke and from off the throne, and that echoes out of the temple, and that voice is most certainly the voice of God. He is the one who has the glory and the power in the temple, the only one who is present in the temple, for all are out now. And that voice is mighty. It's called here a great voice out of the temple. It's something like that voice that Isaiah described at the end of his prophecy when he says, "A voice came from the temple, a voice of the Lord that rendereth recompense to his enemies." And I think that's the same voice that John is hearing. It's a voice of the Lord, and it's a voice that's rendering recompense to all his enemies. We know from the Bible that when God utters his voice, it is a mighty thing. There are great effects when God utters his voice. It's not a voice uttered in vain. It's a voice that is glorious, and mighty things take place when he speaks. And this voice coming out of the temple, it actually reminds us of Psalm 29, a psalm wherein the temple is mentioned. Even more mentioned in that psalm is the voice of the Lord. It's the psalm of the voice of the Lord. The voice of the Lord is upon the waters. That's this voice that John is hearing. And the earth is going to feel the effects of that very soon. The God of glory thundereth. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is full of majesty. The voice of the Lord breaketh the cedars. And the cedars are the biggest trees that you read about in the Bible. They've grown for years up in Lebanon's mountains, strong, tall, massive, and yet when the Lord's voice thunders, they just snap. The Lord breaketh the cedars of Lebanon. The voice of the Lord divideth the flames of fire. The voice of the Lord shakes the wilderness. The voice of the Lord makes the hinds the calf. That is, the beasts are frightened by it, and they bear their young early. And he discovers the forest and makes them burr with his voice. And in his temple, the same temple that we've seen here in this book, in his temple, in connection with this voice, everyone speaks of his glory. Where is this smoke coming from? It's coming from his glory and his power. And now the voice is being manifested to demonstrate that glory and power. So Psalm 29 very definitely ought to come to our mind when we read this portion of Holy Scripture. The voice of God is devastating to all his enemies. The voice of God is going to be devastating to the kingdom of the beast. It's going to be devastating to all those who have received the mark. And so this chapter shows that whenever God speaks, the nations will know it. So it's this voice that causes the plagues upon the earth. The voice starts chapter 16. You will notice that the voice launches the plagues. And they are launched, or they're poured out, if you like, through instruments. They don't directly come from God's hand, because the voice says, go your ways and pour out the vials of the wrath of God upon the earth. So the voice is to the angels. This is how God works. This is how God governs the cosmos and the world. He uses his instruments. He ordains means. And those means are very often used by creatures that he hath created. So he uses all creatures in his kingdom. But he especially uses his angels to carry out his decrees, to see that his providence comes to pass. He uses the instrumentality of angels. And so the voice is to the angels, go your ways. Pour out the bowls of the wrath of God upon the earth. Now each angel, there are seven angels, each angel has a different plague. Now while the plagues are different, they do have some things in common. They are all plagues. They all come from bowls. They are each associated with the wrath of God, the bowls of the wrath of God upon the earth. And each bowl is poured out by an angel of God who has been commissioned to pour it out. So those are all the similarities, although they're all different judgments and different plagues. And the lesson very clearly from this chapter is that often on the earth, that's what it says here, underline it, upon the earth, often upon the earth, plagues, catastrophes, disasters and judgments are sent by God. He often sends judgments upon the earth. And these seven plagues certainly are that. They're judgments. They're catastrophes or disasters. They are things that seem to affect the nature and the climate. But they are divinely caused, and they are divine judgments. But you will observe, and this is what I emphasize tonight, that these judgments are carried out by the angels of God. The angels do the judgments. The angels empty the bowls. Now, no doubt God uses fallen angels even. He uses them. We know that he is sovereign even over the fallen, the demons, and they're not even outside his control. But he commissions from the temple his holy angels. These are holy angels. They are chosen by him to be instruments of judgment. They're holy angels because of their origin and because of their dress. We know that they came out of the temple. Chapter 15, verse 6. The angels, the seven angels, came out of the temple. And they're clothed in pure and white linen. So these aren't demons. These aren't fallen angels. Evil angels bringing these things. And the devil's kind of using them. No, these are good, holy angels who are dressed in the garments of purity and holiness. They have no sin, no defilement. What they do in complete and perfect righteousness. So they are not emptying out bowls as devils would empty out bowls with that malice, that hatred, that devilish glee that marks them. They do this as holy ministers of God who have just left the temple and are clothed in pure and white linen and have golden girdles on, as if they are ones who are close to God and have God's ear to pray to. These are those kind of messengers. So there's no way they're devils or demons. They're holy angels. And as holy angels, they are used as instruments of divine judgment, as the ones who carry out and dispense the divine wrath, as the one who does the execution with the sword. God provides the sword, they do the execution. God provides the bowls, they pour them out. They do the execution of the judgments. That's what I'm saying. So God sends his judgments through instruments and agents that he commissions. Now, I don't want you to think that angels only do judgments. They do far more joyful things than that. They do sweeter things than that. They are also instruments of blessing to God's people. We know that. They do good on the earth. They bring blessing to the saints. They pour out bowls of blessing also on occasions. And we know that they are commissioned by the Lord to be protectors of the saints, to protect the church. Doesn't the Bible say the angel of the Lord encamps about them that fear him? So they do security, they do guard duty. They look after God's people. Remember how that psalm goes? Even the devil quoted it to the Lord. He'll give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways. Remember how Daniel said, whenever they threw him in amongst all the hungry lions, and nobody could figure out why those hungry lions didn't eat him up? What did Daniel say? Oh, my God just sent his angel. And he shut their mouths. So there was an angel's hand just holding all the mouths of the lions. An actual angel was there. An actual angel was present to do it. Now, God from his holy throne could have just spoke the word and, you know, it just could have shut their lions' mouths and that would have been the same thing. But no, he uses angels. That's how he works. That's why he created them. He has things to teach them. He wants to cause them to grow in the knowledge of him, as he wants us to grow in the knowledge of him as well. And that's very often through service and ministry. So he uses angels. Do you remember whenever Lazarus died? It was the angels who assisted him to get to the bosom of Abraham. Whatever lies beyond death, there must be twists and turns in it all. And it's not all plain sailing. And so the angels are needed to guide the souls into the haven of rest. So angels are used. And those are sweet ministries, comforting ministries. Remember how the apostle to the Hebrews said, they're all ministering spirits. Not just spirits, but spirits who have been created to minister, to carry out God's decrees, to do his service and his bidding. And they're ministering spirits, especially sent forth, just like here, sent forth, but they're also sent forth to minister to the heirs of salvation, to Christians. Angels do minister to us in sweet ways, in ways that they delight. In Hebrews chapter 1, Christ is seen to be superior to angels. They're the highest creatures in God's universe. Christ created them, and they serve him, and they serve the church. They minister to the church, you see, they're like deacons. I think it might be a similar word. They are like deacons who are just ministering to the church for Christ's sake. So they have those pleasant tasks, those sweet duties, and they love those duties and must enjoy that. And all their ministry, whatever it is powerful. Because the Bible tells us that angels are strong and mighty, and that they're capable of doing many things beyond what mankind can do. And I dare say, if it come to it, if it was one angel versus all of humanity, I think it would be the one angel that would win. So mighty and so strong are they. And the Bible even calls them that, his mighty angels. Ye angels that excel in strength, that do his commandments. So their ministry is sweet. However, it is not limited to the sweet things. And it's not limited to the church. And that is what chapter 16 is all about. It even extends to all the earth. Not just to the camp of the saints in the earth, but also to that other camp in the earth, the camp of the wicked. And so the angels also work in that camp. But they work in that camp in a very different way. So they have a ministry of helping, but they also have a ministry of harming. A ministry of hurting. There are people hurting in chapter 16. And they're hurting because of these holy angels. So in the chapter before us, their commission charges them to hurt. Pour out the vials of the wrath of God upon the earth. To strike and smite the earth with the intention of causing it to feel it. These are instruments then of judgment. And angels can not only harm men, they can even slay men, kill men, if called thereto. And you see this in the Old Testament very regularly. In fact, you meet the idea of lethal angels very early on in the Bible. Because you remember after God put Adam and Eve outside the Garden of Eden, that it says that he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubim. Cherubim who had a flaming sword, and they turned every way to keep the garden. Now it decayed obviously over time, and the flood wiped it away with that destruction. But for a season, it had to be kept by fiery angels with swords. Swords that they were prepared to use. You can see there that they were instruments to cut off, instruments to inflict death if necessary. You remember the story of Balaam, the angel of the Lord and Balaam. Do you remember how the angel of the Lord stood with his sword and was going to smite Balaam, the false prophet? The ass saw him. And eventually the ass scolded Balaam. The angel at the last declared to Balaam, "You know, your donkey, he saw me. If he hadn't have saw me and hadn't have did what he did, I would have smitten you." So there again, the idea of an angel smiting the wicked, cutting off the wicked, being an instrument of judgment. You remember in Sodom, the angel struck the sinners about Lot's house with blindness. He hurt them with blindness. They struggled to see and to feel their way. Then you recall David, how he saw the angel of the Lord over Jerusalem with the sword, identifying with the pestilence, with the plague that was soon going to hit the city that had already devoured the land. It was an angel identified with all of that. Remember how the Assyrians, how the Bible says that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. They were dead corpses by the morning. 185,000 souls, one angel, dead corpses, smitten. We saw on an earlier occasion about Herod, whenever he was waxed with pride and gave kind of positive responses to the idea that he was a god. And we read that the angel of the Lord smote him, and he was eaten up of worms. Now, people would just see the worms. They'd just see the bowels all gushed out and the agony that he was while that took place. But they didn't see the instrument that sent down to smite his bowels and to cause that horrific disease. It was an angel. An angel caused it. The angel smote him. And so in keeping with the paint materials of the Old Testament, and especially the plagues of Egypt in the Old Testament, which it seems also were linked with angels, this chapter is painted using those paint materials. We believe that the angels were involved in the plagues of Egypt because while God sent them and while they are identified with the symbolism of Moses' rod, there actually had to be somebody working, instruments working, affecting and bringing in these things. And it was the angels that are used to do so. And so the psalm says, Psalm 78, "He cast upon them the fierceness of his anger, wrath, and indignation and trouble." This is a description of what God did to Egypt. The same description can be written over chapter 16. He cast upon them, like emptying a bowl, he cast upon them indignation, anger, trouble, wrath, by sending evil angels among them. That's how he did it. Now, some have thought that these are fallen angels, evil angels. Some have thought it's just a reference to the plagues generally, as if the plagues are personified. The plagues are evil angels, evil messengers sent by God. They're kind of personified. But I think the reference has got to be to the instrumentality of the angels of God, who are commissioned, who are sent by God. And I think it's a reference to the angels who are the instruments of those judgments. They're holy angels. They're not called evil angels because they are wicked and evil morally in themselves. No, they are called evil because that's how they appear to those who are afflicted by them, who bring the evils. They bring physical evil. They bring the evils upon the body. And because they bring evil, they don't bring moral evil, they don't bring sin. But because they bring this evil, this indignation, this judgment, this wrath, and that has terrible effects on the body, which we call evils. You know, we go through evils, and we're not always talking about sin. We're just talking about evil problems and troubles. And I think that's why they're called evil angels, because they bring evil. Not moral evil, but the evils that our bodies don't like. And I think Revelation 16 bears this out. And there are many comparisons between the plagues, the seven plagues in chapter 16. We haven't time to show that tonight. But there are many comparisons between the seven plagues here and the 10 plagues that were on Egypt. And certainly the parallelism here, I believe, extends to the angels. The angels were used in the dispensing of the law, we know. The angels are used in the execution of sinners who sin against the law. And so, in a real sense, angels emptied the bowls over Egypt, as they do here in chapter 16, over the kingdom of the beast. So the angels are the instruments that are used. What I'm saying, congregation, is that angels can smite men in the dearest and sweetest objects of their lives. The things that they hold dear, the things that are so life to them. Angels can smite those things so that they become detestable evils. Just as in this chapter. Men love their bodies, don't they? They like their bodies to be at ease and be pain-free so that they can indulge the flesh unrestricted. One of these plagues imparts to their bodies grievous and noisome sores. And the sweetness of a pain-free body is removed in the judgment of God. And then upon the sea, how men like the sea, how they like to go to the seaside, how they like to be, those that are wealthy and rich, to be on their yachts and on their boats, and all the economy of the world running on the sea, and all the prosperity of the money and the transport of goods. The sea is so important to man. The sweetness of the sea. And God pours the plague on it. Comes like the blood of a dead man. Not so sweet now. Then the rivers and the fountains. Then the sun, how men worship the sun and love the sun. And the sun becomes super powerful to scorch them. And that sweetness is gone. And so God hits them where it hurts. That's what he's doing. He's hitting them where it hurts. Taking the sweetness out of life in his divine judgments. What can we say about the angels in this chapter as angels of judgment? Well, the first thing is, whenever they are sent, they come. Whenever they're told to go to a place, they arrive. They go. They are told to go. Go your ways. The angels that excel in strength, we are told in the Bible, also do his commandments, and they hearken unto the voice of his word. When they're told to go, they go. They're obedient. Even if the task isn't pleasant, even if the task isn't easy, even if it's not a job that would be one of sweetness to them, like working with the people of God, they go still. You remember how our Lord taught us to pray, thy will be done on earth like it's done in heaven. How's it done in heaven? It's done all the time, done perfectly, done without hesitation or without question. When God says go to any angel in heaven, he goes. It's not like that on earth. Every angel
can say who does his commission that God sends him on, like Gabriel. What did Gabriel say? I'm sent to speak unto thee. And that's why I'm here. When an angel's sent to a place, he goes. He's there. He arrives. No hesitation, no delay, no possibility of disobedience. These angels didn't follow Satan, and they are confirmed in unflinching and unfading holiness and obedience. And not one of them do a Jonah. And none of them have to be encouraged. None of them have to be told, if thou wilt hearken diligently to my word, if thou wilt listen to what I say to you, and if you do that which is right in my sight, I'll bless you and I'll do good. He doesn't have to say that to the angels the way he has to say to us. He doesn't have to say to warn the angels, say, now if you don't do it, I'll chasten you, I'll judge you. He doesn't have to say that to the angels. All he has to say, go. Without any encouragement, without any incentives, without any warnings. He gives us that all the time. His word is full of explanation and reasons and encouragements and incentives. The angels don't need a Bible like that. God just says, go your ways. Off you go. And they go. They not only go, they arrive. They come to their destination. So that's the first thing. This obedience. The second thing is, if God bids them pour, they don't spur. They don't hold back. They don't lessen the intensity of the verb. If God says pour, they pour. That's to be noticed, especially about this chapter. God said, verse 1, pour out the vials. And then look at verse 2. The first went and poured out his vial. And then verse 3, and the second angel poured out his vial. And the third angel poured out his vial. And we go down through them all, the fourth and the fifth and the sixth and the seventh. The last one, it's the same story. The seventh angel poured out his vial. The way God wanted it done. Not half-hearted. Not in drips and drabs. God said pour, they didn't sprinkle. God said pour, they didn't, you know, leave the bowl half-filled. They did what God said. They didn't hold back. Now, how do they feel about this? Have you ever tried to enter into the feeling of an angel that has to do this? Kill people? Kill men? Certainly they are not harmed by what they do, the way wicked men are harmed whenever they kill. You see, their hearts are holy and pure. They have no sin. And what they do in obedience to God, and they do in a righteous and a just way. They pour out the bowls. And they know God is just and righteous, and some of them even say it, other angels. Do they feel pity? Have you thought about that? Is there a bitterness in this work for them that they carry out? Though they do not flinch at the obedience, that's for certain, but is there pity? How do they feel? You know, it's not easy to kill. Even in a just war, so-called just war, in fact, the more you think about it, I don't even know if there is such a thing as a just war on earth whenever mankind are doing the fighting. When it comes to killing, it's not easy, even if you think you're on the right side. Whenever men come back from war, good men, the best of men who fought in war, one thing they don't talk about is the killing. They're always silent on that. What they had to do in the battlefield, even the killing enemies, is something they try to forget. It's something that they do not want to retain in their memories. Killing, whether it's in a just war or not, killing leaves men psychologically damaged. It's not for no reason that God says, thou shalt not kill. It's not only for the benefit of those that would be killed, it's for the benefit of those who would be killers.
In fact, in war, it is known that, especially whenever lots of people are called up, and people who aren't, you know, born soldiers and want to get into the army, it's known that many of them will not kill. And they will deliberately mis-aim. I won't kill. In fact, some would choose to be killed before they kill because they know the traumatic impact it will have upon them to kill. Even to kill someone accidentally doesn't leave a person the same. There's something in our nature that causes us to be damaged when we harm others, and especially when we kill others. And of course, there are a tiny percentage of killers who are sadistic and seem to be unaffected by the trauma at all and completely enjoy it. And thankfully, such people are few and rare, and they are usually demon-possessed and in the realm of probably having committed unpardonable sin. But angels do not suffer perpetration-induced traumatic stress when they execute the judgments of God and cut off sinners in the earth, because they are perfectly sinless. They're doing it in perfect justice and righteousness, in perfect obedience to God, and all the sinners that they do it on utterly deserve it. Angels do not suffer trauma. These angels do not hold back. God bids them pour, and they do not spur. They do not question a just and holy God. They do not miss aim. They do not deliberately go off the mark. They do not deliberately pour the vial somewhere else where it will be less effective. If they have pity, their pity does not bring them into the realm of disobedience to God. So they operate in a perfectly just cause and do not exceed ever the bounds of justice and righteousness, nor do they miss the limits of them by not carrying out their duty. The angels acting thus just goes to show how wicked the earth is. The world is so vile that God has to send his armies to deal with it, heaven's hosts. The Bible says, he shall have judgment without mercy, who shows no mercy. And if God has no mercy for these people on the earth, then the angels are not to show any either. And they pour out their bowls. They empty them. No holding back. And when Christ returns in glory to deal with the wicked world, they come gladly and willingly with him. Angels of fiery judgment. And then the third thing, quite obvious from this chapter, and this is the final thing, is that they cannot be resisted. If God says to them, go, and if God tells them, pour, none can stand in their way. None can stop them. None can block up their path to stop their journey. None can hold their hand and restrain their arms so that they cannot pour or limit the pouring somehow of the judgments. Nobody gets in their way. They are the untouchables. They are the ones who cannot be resisted. None can halt, even when those bowls are poured out. None can halt the flow of the judgments upon the earth. The impotence of man is obvious in chapter 16, and the power of God stands glorious. However mighty men are on the earth, one angel
is mightier. You will observe that there are only seven angels here. Just seven. Seven is enough. In fact, I dare say one would have been sufficient to do it all, going out and returning and just going out with seven bulls herself. One angel could do it, but seven is symbolic of the perfection of God's judgment. And to show that no angel is God, but that all angels must act together in obedience to God, acting together in wonderful unity and wonderful harmony, carrying out the judgment of God. But really, God doesn't need too many angels to deal with man. Hell responds, as we know, particularly in the sixth plague. But even that response was planned by the strategy of heaven in the sixth bowl. We read the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates. The river was dried up for the way of the kings of the east, that might be prepared. And then the armies come together. The armies are coming together, all the armies of the world. Not even the armies of the world can halt God's judgment. So here at the sixth plague, all the power of the earth in the vision, whatever that means when it comes to fulfillment, I have no idea. But in the vision, when all these armies come together, as it were, at the sixth plague, to finally they've, you know, got together to deal with God, to deal with his wrath, to war with him. They've all got together, but it doesn't stop the last angel. It doesn't stop the seventh bowl being poured out. It's utterly powerless. Even all the armies of the kings of the earth are utterly powerless. And this is what the vision is showing. We have to be careful when we come to the literal interpretation, and people have a great lot of imagination about all of that. Well, I don't go into the areas of imagination. It is the obvious truths that can be drawn forth that are set forth in the vision. And the obvious truth is the impotence of man when it comes to one angel pouring out the divine bowls of judgment upon them. God wins. God wins the day.